The following podcast contains language that may not be appropriate for all listeners.
So I come here to San Quentin, and it's like the most intimidating place in the world, right? You get to prison, and like it's scary. It's, you know, like you've only seen it in movies, and like I'm walking into reception, and it's so loud. People are just yelling and screaming, and this one guy's like, "Hey, that's him!" And I'm like, "What the fuck? Like, no way! Like, does someone like know me?" And they're like, "Hey, that's that." That's that motherfucker that killed Ray Ray. And then someone else yells, "Oh, he killed Ray Ray? Hey, that motherfucker's here. He killed Ray Ray." I'm like, I don't know who Ray Ray is. Who's Ray Ray? So I'm like walking to my son. I'm like, oh, this can't get any worse. I'm like,
oh, hell yeah, Ken. He hasn't even met his celly yet.
And then standing there in front of the door, like I hadn't even seen him because the light was off there, is my celly. And he's like 6 feet tall, like just wide and like, the light in there, like, it strobes, like, it was broken. So, like, I would catch, like, glimpses of him, like, and he's just, like, this beard that goes down to, like, his belly. And, like, he's got, like, his, where he's from, like, tattooed on his stomach. And, like, wizards and dragons, like, all, like, the classic, like, white boy tattoos, you know what I mean? And, like, Raiders from back, like, when they were, like, in L.A., you know what I mean? Like, super, like, old school, like, it's, like, his fifth term. And he's got, like, all of, like, four teeth in his mouth. And we can only wear our boxers, so he's, like, just in his white shorts and his sandals. I was like, so you in here by yourself? And he's like, yeah, killed my last celly. And I was like, oh my God, so awful. And then he's like, no, I'm just kidding. Come here. And he like picks me up and like puts me on my rack. And he's like, you like burritos? And like, he like makes me all this food. And the bottom line was like, really, he was just like some older gentleman that just hadn't had a celly in like 4 months. And like, he was just so excited to have company. And he's like, oh, look at all this stuff I got. Like, and he's showing me like all these magazines. Like, isn't she hot? And like, oh yeah, like they snuck. And it turns out we both really like that movie, Step Brothers. And so we'd always like sit there and go like, boats and hoes, man.
You're now tuned in to San Quentin's Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia. I'm Erline Woods. I'm incarcerated at San Quentin State Prison in California.
I'm Nigel Poor, a visual artist who volunteers at the prison.
And together, we're going to take you inside.
Today in the podcast, we're talking about firsts.
Yeah, like the first day in San Quentin, the first visit with moms.
The first time out of prison on a medical visit, all kinds of firsts.
Yep, and speaking of firsts, this is the first episode of season 2 of Ear Hustle.
So if you're new to the show, thanks for joining us. And if you listened to season 1, welcome back. And really, thank you for hanging in while we were on break.
Right.
Although, wait a minute, what? We weren't really on break.
Hell no, we wasn't on break. We was plotting out season 2. And we knew you were there because Nige told me all about all the comments on Instagram. I've read all the postcards. She's told me about all the tweets, all the letters that's been coming in, and some cool artwork. We've been getting a lot.
We've been getting some really beautiful artwork. Thank you. And it's amazing. It really lets us know that we've connected with people and that we're opening a dialogue. So we're so glad to be back.
We are proud to be back.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Ear Hustle comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/earhustle. That's odoo.com/earhustle. Odoo. Modern management made simple.
Talk to anyone here, from the guys on the main line to the volunteers and staff, and they all have a first story.
Yeah, that's true. And some of them are like Shane's story at the top about his first day at San Quentin.
And some involve family visits, visits from mom.
Michael Thompson's been in prison for 30 years. He remembers the first time he met his mom in the visiting room.
So I was in prison about 7 years, and I felt like I was like thrown away. And I had wrote a letter to my sister and basically told everybody, I'm cool on y'all. Y'all ain't came to see me. Nobody's, you know, trying to interact with me. And so about a week later, I called my sister and like, hey, did you get that letter I wrote you? Because I'm done with you guys. And she was like, before you get all upset, hot and bothered, your mother's on the way out there right now. And I was like, what? She's on the way out there. And then I heard him call me over the microphone. Like, Michael Thompson visit. So I was like, oh, shit, I don't care how mad I am. I'm coming to see my mama. I got to go shave and this and that. Or if I even had a mustache then, because this was 24 years ago. And I went to the visit, and my mother was sitting there. And she was like, I didn't think he was going to come out. And we were sitting out there talking, and I was explaining. And I was like, man, I'm out here by myself. It feels like y'all just like, okay, we'll see you when you get out. And they was like, nah, it's because of money. You know, just basically we're homeless. And, you know, you left us too. And I was like, man, yeah, I didn't really look at it like that. So we really had a real good visit, got a lot of kind of skeletons snatched out the closet. And it had been 5 years since I seen her, but 7 years since I've touched her.
What was it like when the first time you hugged your mom?
It kind of made me feel like connected, right? It like really brought me back to who I was before I came to jail, as opposed to this person that I had become. I hadn't smiled in like 5 years, you know? So it was an awakening, almost like a recharging of my soul. All that anger and frustration and rage that I was feeling towards myself, my situation, it just like water on the bridge. Like, this is my mom right here. The world is blocked out. I don't care anything about it. But and the time is going by like so fast. So we were out there from maybe 9:30 to 3. And it seemed like 5 minutes.
Power of that hug, the healing power of touch.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that a lot. When guys are in here, a lot of them don't really have much, if any, physical contact.
And sometimes we're in here for so long without touching or hugging anyone, we don't even know how to do that anymore. Basically, we out of practice. Which brings us to another first. Adnan Khan has been in prison since 2003, and he told us about the first time he saw his mom after 10 years in prison.
The thing I wanted to talk to you about was your first visit with your mom. Oof. And, yeah. How did you prep?
So let me get the emotional prep out of the way. I took a lot of deep breaths. I tried to, like, choreograph my hug, because I haven't hugged my mom in a long time, but in the cell. But
Wait. How did you practice? How did you choreograph a hug?
So I didn't know, because I haven't hugged someone in a long time. Maybe by then it was 13 years, right? So I didn't know if my hand goes around her shoulder or her neck. I didn't know if it went like diagonally, like two 45 degree angles. And then I was like, you know what? I let her lead. Like, this is your mom, right? This is my mom. And I don't know how to hug my mom. So I was nervous about that type of stuff.
Did you actually practice hugging somebody else?
No.
Just like an air hug?
My cellie wasn't up for that. No, I did not. I just kind of like air hugged myself. And I didn't know exactly, like, okay, what do you do? Up? Is it down? Is it sideways? So, like, that's what I was nervous about.
He had a lot to be nervous about after 10 years. That's a long time. And this is a longer story. And like Adnan's feelings about his mother, it's also complicated.
Yeah, a lot of guys in here have complicated relationships with their families. Some guys don't want to go see their families. Some families don't want to go visit the guys, or they just too far away, or they just simply moved on with their lives. Let's get back to Adnan and his complicated relationship with his mother. The last time he seen his mom was in court when he was being sentenced.
My mom is being called on the witness stand to speak on my behalf. And inside, I'm feeling like this is useless. There's nothing you can say or do that's going to change anything. It's over. I'm getting sentenced. Why are you coming up here You're embarrassing me. You're embarrassing yourself. Like, you don't get it. You never got it. Why don't you get it? She gets on the stand and she's telling the judge all these good things about me. That I'm a good kid. I'm a smart kid. I'm funny. I cook. I do this. I do that. Pleading, like literally pleading to the judge, like, please, please, like, be lenient on my son. Please be lenient. And when she's saying this, when she's telling the judge this, all I felt was hurt. I felt like going up there and just stopping her and holding her and tell her it'll be okay. But I couldn't. So I just sat there. She's in tears. And she looked at the district attorney. She looked at the victim's family. She looked at the judge. I mean, when she did look at me, I looked away.
So Adnan was sentenced to 25 years to life, and he was sent to a level 4 maximum security prison. When he came to prison, he didn't want to see his mom, ever.
And 5 years into his sentence, he is surprised to hear over the loudspeaker, "Khan, you have a visit." It was his mom. And he refused to go see her.
You know, like, how dare you come and take my power of decision away from me? You haven't been there for me. And I'm going to show you. You're going to come on my terms and my terms only.
10 years later, Adnan's feelings about his mom had softened, and he finally agreed to a visit.
We're going to hear about that visit. But before we get there, let's hear about another first experience here at San Quentin.
My name is Rahsaan Thomas, and the first time I ran a marathon in San Quentin State Prison, I broke 2 records.
I couldn't believe it when I first started coming to San Quentin, and there was a running club called the 1,000 Mile Club.
Yeah.
And they have volunteer coaches that come in from the outside, and there is an annual San Quentin marathon.
26.2 miles, running around and around and around. And around the yard. This is just like NASCAR, just circles.
I know, and it's not like it's a nice track, right?
No, I mean, it's, you know, half the track is asphalt. Then you go across what is the lower yard, which is the San Quentin Field of Dreams, which is the baseball diamond. Then you go into this rocky dirt, uneven part, right? Where it's like, watch where you're going, you might break an ankle.
It's more like an obstacle course. And you know how there are all those geese out there?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's got to be another obstacle.
No, the geese and the pigeons in San Quentin is like, they like, man, they don't even get out the way.
No, they're lazy.
They don't get out the way. They just, you know, you just walk
around. Some might even say they're rude.
They're very rude.
And the other thing is, you have to run past like those outside toilets, like 100 times.
That's actually 105 times to be exact, because that's how many laps equal to 26.2 miles. And I'm nowhere near there.
So when I started the run, it felt pretty good, like driving down a highway at night with no traffic. Like, you're just flying and you're just flowing. And I got to this point where I wasn't seeing the prison anymore. I was just seeing the next step in front of me, right? And I was in that zone. And people running past me, though, I noticed they got a guy in the club named Markel, the Gazelle Taylor. He's fast. He lapped me twice before my first mile, so I knew it was going to be a long day for me. But I still was in the zone. But after a while, the running that felt like flying felt like pain. And so I talked a lot of crap about how Sean Puffy Combs ran the New York City Marathon, and that if Puffy can do it from Mount Vernon, then me being from Brownsville, Brooklyn, ain't no way Puffy tougher than me. If he can run a marathon, I'm gonna run a marathon. And so I didn't realize what that meant till I got to mile 11. And my body cramped up, and I ended up doing a lot, half walking, half running. But I got through. Towards the end, though, when it was the toughest, like the last 5 miles, that point where you've gone further than you really can go, but you're too close to quit. But it still is 5 more miles, which is 20 more laps. And then Jonathan True, one of my fellow club members, he had already completed his marathon, and he ran the last 2 miles with me. We've never had 13 people complete a marathon. And so by me completing that marathon, I made number 13 and set a club record. The second record I got, it took me 6 hours, 15 minutes, 23 seconds. So I got the longest marathon time ever in San Quentin State Prison. I survived. I'm still alive. Lieutenant thought I couldn't do it.
Can you imagine running for more than 6 hours straight on that friggin' boring track?
Fuck. Man. No, it ain't that serious to me. I mean, I run, but I'm not really into it like that. But what I also can't imagine is what it would be like seeing my mom after 10 years.
Yeah, yep, yep. Let's go back to Adnan's story. His mother's about to visit, and he's obsessing about every detail.
The night before, I got some brand new pants, a nice button-up shirt. I washed it. I cleaned it. I had brand new boots. And just to make sure, I polished them one more time. I went in line for the iron. And I wanted to be extra nice, extra crispy, extra creased up. My mom taught me how to always look good, look your best. And having that in my head, I want to make sure that my pants and my shirt are ironed perfectly. I go back to my cell holding my shirt with my thumb and my forefinger. I don't want to wrinkle it at all. And I hang it up and I put a plastic bag over it so there's no dust gets on it. I wake up in the morning, I make my shot of coffee, I play music, I do my normal routine. I clean the floor. While I'm drinking my coffee, I sit down, turn on the news, and about half hour before my visit is about to come, I put my clothes on, I'm clean. Even when once I had my clothes on, it was very strategic way I sit down because I didn't want to wrinkle anything. So I sit down very carefully. I don't want to lean in too much or lean back on my bunk too much because that causes or that creates a lot of creases. So I just put like a mannequin, just sit there on the edge of my bunk for about half an hour until they call me for a visit. Khan, cell 219, you have a visit. And then like my heart dropped. My door opens, it buzzes open. So I walk to the visit room. I don't know the procedures. I just know the outside door says visiting. And once you enter, I have no idea what the inside looks like. So I get in, I'm confused. I'm looking around, trying to read signs. So there's a guy who was in front of me. I kind of just followed him. And then he put his ID in like a little slot. So I put my ID in there. I got my final pat down. The CO says, go ahead, go through your door, enjoy your visit. Definitely my legs are shaking. My legs are weak. And as soon as I came through the door, like about 5 feet in front of the door, there was my mom just standing there.
Hey, Erlan, isn't this something that happens to people when they've been in prison for a long time? They kind of forget how to be around outside people.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that here at San Quentin when, like, guys come from the maximum security prisons. I mean, in San Quentin, there are a lot of outside people coming inside the prison every day. And some guys get spooked. They don't know the rules. They don't know how to interact. It's kind of weird for them.
But even with all the outsiders in San Quentin, some guys still have trouble with social situations that outsiders wouldn't think twice about.
You can see it when guys have to leave this prison to go outside for, I don't know, some kind of medical service that they can't get on the inside.
There's very few times when guys actually leave the prison during their time here. But next, we're going to hear about one guy's trip outside the prison walls.
My name is Jason Jones, and the first time in about 13 years I got in a car was when I went to go get my wisdom teeth taken out. I went to San Francisco, and they had me shackled in an orange suit. And as I'm looking at the scenery and I'm watching everybody drive, it's like tripping me out because everybody's driving crazy. The cop literally hit the brakes a couple times as he was getting close to the cars and stuff like that. And I would just like have like going through these anxiety attacks in the back of the car. And when I finally got into the city, I didn't realize that it was going to be so many people down there. And I thought we was going to go through the back where we can just like sneak in through the back. But no, we parked right on the street. Parallel parking to the curb, and the dentist office was right between like a clothing store and a restaurant. And right when I got out, it was people running, jogging, riding bikes on their phones, and like they see me, but they didn't see me. And like it was completely shocking to me because it was the first time in a long time I was around so many people that was just moving at a fast pace, and it wasn't like no riot or nothing like that. I didn't know how to take it. I wasn't prepared for that. I was overwhelmed. And so, like, I started, like, breathing heavy and everything. The cop asked me if I was all right. I was like, nah, I'm not really all right. And then he had to, like, tell everybody to stop before they can escort me in.
because I was just like having an anxiety attack.
Were you shocked that that was your response?
I was very shocked because I thought, you know, the interaction that I had in prison with outside people, that I was like more social. But yeah, it showed me I have a lot more work to do, and I'm a lot more institutionalized than I thought I was.
You know, Earlonne, he's a young guy, and I guess I expected to hear that when he got a chance to get out there, he'd be totally ready to jump into the mix.
I'll say this. The first time I went out, I was good.
Wait, when did you go out?
I went out a couple of years ago for a shoulder x-ray, and we was in a party bus, so it was cool. It was like, you know, it was cool. It was open space. But the second time I went, they took me in like a little van, and it was like a tuna can inside of a tuna can. It was like a can inside of a van.
What do you mean? You were like in a cage?
I was in a cage. So it was like kind of claustrophobic. So when we was going over the bridge, I couldn't think past, if this guy crashed, they not going to save me in the back. It's too many keys to bro. If he crash and go over the bridge and into the water, I mean, it's preservation of self, I would assume, because that's a lot to get to me.
That's, you know what? You bring up a really good point, because I drive over that bridge every time I come here. I never think about what's going to happen if my car goes off the bridge.
See, you're not in a tuna can.
No.
Inside of a can.
No, I'm not.
You know, and handcuffed.
Yeah, no, that's a really good example.
So that's the only thing I thought about.
Oh, God. Okay, so let's go back to Adnan. He just opened the door to the visiting room.
Yeah, and usually it's so chaotic, you have to look for your visitor. It's like, where's Waldo? But for Adnan, after 10 years, his mom was right there on the other side of the door waiting.
Her hair was done nice. She still looked youthful. And her face was light-skinned. Right? And that's something like in my family, my mom was like always the lightest one, that light skin. So that's one of the first things I noticed, that her face was bright. It stood out. Her skin stood out. And she just smiled. And when she smiled, I came up to her. I kind of gave her a side hug, but she grabbed me with both arms. And that hug was uncomfortable for me, because I felt her squeezing me more, and she didn't want to kind of let go. And I'm trying to pry her off of me, but be respectful at the same time. So I kind of hug her with one side of my body and one arm. And when she tightens up a little bit, I kind of pull back, and I'm trying to pry her off of me. And then I was like, come on, let's go sit down. And there was literally not a seat available except for a kids section. So we sit down in the kids section, and it just felt very weird to me to watch little kids in a kids section playing with toys with their mother. And here I am, a grown man, 30 years old, with his mom. We started off with a lot of small talk. How you doing? How are you doing? Everything's good. I'm up to this. I'm doing this. Kept looking at the clock. I know I have several hours to do. I just want this day to be over. I wish my sister was there or somebody else was here where I could divvy up my attention, but it was just me and my mom. So I sit here with her, and I'm having this conversation about stuff that doesn't mean anything, when we both know there's this huge elephant in the room that neither of us are addressing.
That elephant in the room, it's a big one. It's how Adnan grew up, and you could say it's what led to his incarceration.
Adnan had family problems from a very young age. Basically, his mom and dad divorced when he was 8. His stepdad didn't like him. And when he was 16, his mom left the state and Adnan to be with another man.
So by 17, he was homeless and living on the streets of Pittsburgh, California, or with friends who sometimes took him in.
So one day, we're at a friend's house, and we're smoking weed, we're getting high, watching 8 Mile, Eminem.
There are about four guys hanging out, and one of them makes a suggestion.
He said, hey, look, man, I have a friend, and he's a square, meaning that he's not going to hurt anybody. He doesn't carry weapons. He's not going to have a gun. Look, he has $1,000 worth of marijuana. And look, all you got to do is take it, get in a car, and drive off. There wasn't a thought. I was like, yeah.
Things didn't go as planned. The guy with the weed ended up getting killed by Adnan's partner. Adnan says his partner stabbed him to death.
So Adnan went from living on the streets to being a juvenile lifer, serving 25 years to life for robbery murder.
So I love ice cream. Ice cream is very rare in prison. You only get it once a month if you go to canteen. So one thing I knew and I was confident about, I'm going to go in there. And I'm going to have me a damn Snickers ice cream. I don't care how much my mom is crying or what the elephant is doing in the room. Matter of fact, the elephant wants ice cream. He could get one too. But I'm going to get me a Snickers ice cream. We bought soda, orange juice, and then I moseyed my way over to the ice cream machine and told my mom, hey, I'll take one of these. Why not? She puts in the $2 and then presses the number. Beep, beep, whatever that was. E2, whatever it was, right? So I'm waiting for it to come out. The little swirly thing that holds the ice cream in place inside the machine, I'm watching it go around and around. And then it stops. I'm like, oh, it got stuck. And then as soon as I say that, the ice cream pushes or something behind it pushes the little ice cream. It tumbles over, it falls down. And then my mom tells me, grab the ice cream. And I'm not sure about the rules if I'm allowed to do it or not. So I told her, I don't think I can grab it. And she said, why not? I felt bad or guilty because I didn't want her to know that what type of rules I'm subjected to as a prisoner. Like standing behind the yellow line, can't go over here, we can't touch. For her to see me in a situation like that, I felt even worse. So anyways, so she grabs the ice cream, she buys another one. We sit down back in the kids section. So here I am with my mommy eating a Snickers ice cream.
And how'd that feel?
So ice cream took a lot of weight off of my shoulders. I don't know if it was because I haven't had Snickers ice cream in a long time or because it was something else to talk about. And then she kept looking at me like enjoying, like, yeah, yeah, my son's enjoying. You know, I've sensed that, like my son's enjoying the ice cream. But it felt good. For the first time, I felt relaxed in the visit room.
Hey, you know, Earlonne, earlier we were talking about touch mm-hmm. and how powerful and necessary that is for pretty much any kind of relationship.
Right.
But there's also food. Mm-hmm. And so much bonding in life happens over food. So many memories of happier times must have come back to Adnan with that ice cream.
Yeah. Think about this, Naj. Food in prison, as everyone knows, isn't great. It's shitty. Now, there's not a lot of memories in prison food.
Not good ones, anyway.
Right. So, Adnan got this Snicker ice cream. We don't get ice cream often. Mm-hmm. We barely get ice cream. The only time we can really get special food is when there's, like, food sales. It's kind of a fundraiser. We get, like, menus to order food off mm-hmm. of. But it don't happen often. It happens, like, maybe twice a year.
Yeah, and they raise money for different charitable organizations. And guys who have money, that's where they can spend some of it. We now have a first food story from Antoine Williams.
Antoine loves Mickey D's, and he hadn't had a Big Mac in the 7 years he'd been incarcerated. But then they had a food sale with McDonald's on the menu. That doesn't happen often.
I ordered one Big Mac, one large fries, and when they deliver the food, it gets here at 9. So around 8:50, I'm waiting my shoes on. I got my little bag. I got my ID to make sure that I don't have no problems. 9 o'clock, the officers unlocking the tiers from the bottom to the top. And I can hear people. Hey, man, they running the food sale. Hey, man, they running the food sale. Are you going to the food sale? Hey, man, give me a spot in line. Like, you can hear everybody, all the chatter. They got to my tier. They opened that bar. It was almost like the Kentucky Derby, the way people were shooting out them damn cells. And I was one of them. I got to the lower yard, and it had to be at least 200 guys in line. So I sat in line for almost 2 hours. And I'm thinking I'm going to receive this nice warm bag where the bag was ice cold. I didn't even give a damn. I shot back up to West Block. I set my ass right on that tier, had my feet dangling off the fifth tier like it was a romantic setting. And I sat there in such peace and tranquility and ate the coldest Big Mac I ever had in my life with them fries. Oh, it was it was like a piece of my past that I was able to have in a moment. And it wiped everything prison away. Like for those maybe 112 seconds it took me to scarf my burger and fries down.
And how long did that relaxed feeling last?
That relaxed feeling didn't last too long because soon after, my mom asked me a question about spirituality. And she says that, like, she's struggling with her spirituality because I'm still in prison. And why is this happening to me? Why is it difficult for her to make all five of her prayers? Why is it difficult for her to get up in the morning? Why is it difficult for her to make a prayer at night before she goes to sleep? And she's actually asking questions, like she wants a solution from me. I found it difficult to give her an answer. And I felt horrible about that. There's an announcement that's made. There's about 30 minutes left for a visit. I get excited. I'm glad it's over. And just to close out, she starts telling me how good she feels. She tells me, I feel so happy. I feel so relieved. It's so good to see you. You look so, you know, you look well. You look good. You look handsome. Right before she leaves, I give her the same kind of hug, the side hug with the one arm around her shoulder, her head. And she reaches in. She grabs me her full strength, both arms, squeezes me. She doesn't want to let go. And again, once again, just like the beginning, I'm trying to pry her off of me. And then when she releases, she grabs my face and kisses me on my cheek. And I said, all right, Mom, all right, I'll see you later. And she walks away. But as she's walking away, she keeps looking back at me. She goes through the glass door. She's still looking back at me. She stands in the line inside the glass door where they're getting processed out. And she's still looking at me, waving, blowing me kisses. You know, that embarrassing stuff mothers do. And I'm like, all right, leave, Mom. Gosh, geez, stop looking at me. That's what I'm thinking inside, squirming. I'm squirming. Like, leave me alone now. It's over. Please, let it be over. And then they call me. Once they call me, I wave goodbye a final time to her. And that was it. Visit ended. It's been 3 years since that visit with my mom. And today, my relationship with my mom is a lot better. And she's really meeting me where I'm at. She's being patient with me. She's letting me do my time. But she does always wants to see me.
But how do you really feel about it? Because that sounds like a very pat answer. Like, okay, now it's better. But yeah. Is it really?
It's better than it was. I tell myself it won't be perfectly back to normal until I get out. But I don't think that's the case either. I feel like, and I hate to say this, but I feel like I'm going to have this distance with my mom for a very long time, whether I'm in prison or not.
Thanks to Adnan for telling us that story. I know it was a difficult one because a lot of guys in here have complicated relationships with their families.
Sure do. Now, before we go, we're going to hear just one more San Quentin first after this short break. Stay with us.
The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. Hear a feed from episodes across NPR podcasts that center Black voices. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Count time, everybody, count time.
Okay, it's count time, Earlon.
Yep. Every day, several times a day, every last prisoner here in San Quentin has to be counted. It's just part of the daily life here.
For Ear Hustle, starting now in season 2, count time is when we do one last thing before we call it quits.
Yep.
It can be like little snippets of audio,
story fragments,
recipes,
spoken words,
outtakes, or the thing you always want,
bloopers. I love bloopers. And this week, our count time is our first interview here in the Media Lab with a correction officer.
Yeah, we were really excited about this one. COs are a big part of the San Quentin community, and we want to get their voices and perspectives on the podcast. But there's been some reluctance there.
Yeah, they walk a tough beat. Being a correction officer is like being in a fraternity. They have their own rules and code of conduct. So in order to warm things up, we started at the top.
With Lieutenant Sam Robinson.
I have a question for you. Can you tell us the first time you were scared in prison?
Well, scared is a strong word. And I think when you work in an environment like this, having fear is not to your benefit. And so I wouldn't say scared is the correct word. I would like to use threatened. People recognize me in the prison because of my name. At one while, there were about 20 of my relatives who worked here at San Quentin. And I remember as a brand new cop, young African-American officer, 21 years ago, I was only a couple of weeks on the job, and I was assigned to work in the Adjustment Center. And the Adjustment Center is the most secure housing unit we have at San Quentin State Prison. There at the time, we housed prison gang members. And there's this one individual I remember, I won't call him by his entire name. If you were to think of the epitome, if you were to draw a picture of an Aryan Brotherhood member, he would fit the mold. The guy had tattoos all over his body. He had worked out every day of his life, and so very, very muscular. He was 6 to 8 inches taller than I was. And as I was walking the guy from the yard back to his cell, he struck up a conversation with me. And I said, you're one of those Robinsons, huh? And I was like, yeah, I'm one of those Robinsons. And so as I was securing him in his cell, the cell door closed, and he was in restraints, and so he put his hands through the food port where we uncuff him. And as I took off his cuff, he turned around and stuck his one arm out in accordance with protocol. And he looked at me, and he said, Robinson, he said, you know, he said, I've been checking you out. He said, you're a good little cop. He say, however, he say, if you know, if I ever get out of these cuffs one day, I'm going to kill you. And so immediately I had to respond. You can't show any fear in an environment like this. You can't be scared. And so my response was, I looked the man in his eye. Of course, I was looking up at him. I looked the man in his eye and I said, Billy, you got to bring some and get some. And after that, took off his other cuff, closed it away, and I never had an issue with the guy. He had the most respectful relationship that I've had inside the walls of a prison. He was very respectful, and I think I got his respect just because I didn't back down to the challenge. I didn't cower down. There was no fear. I addressed him, and the issue was over with.
That's what's up. Thanks to Shane, Michael, Rasan, Antoine, and Jason for sharing their first stories with us.
Hey, E, how's it feel to be back?
Shit, it feels great, you know, to be back hanging out with the listeners again, you know, and this is our first episode of our new season, and we got a bunch of interesting, cool, profound, thought-provoking, we got some great stories coming up for you.
I can't wait. Ear Hustle is produced by myself, Earlon Woods, and Pat Macedi Miller, who also comes in to lead the sound production team. This episode included music by Antoine Williams David Jossi, J.B. Burton, and Dwight Krisman. Our story editor is Curtis Fox, and our executive producer for Radiotopia is Julie Shapiro.
We also want to thank Warden Ron Davis, and you know every episode has to be approved by this guy here.
I am Lieutenant Sam Robinson, the public information officer at San Quentin State Prison, and I approve this story.
Next time on Ear Hustle, another first. This is the first time we're going to be featuring a woman on the podcast.
As we continue this, that's how I will always refer to the individual, is my trafficker. I was 11 years old, and there was an intention when he learned my route. He's a predator.
Ear Hustle is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a collection of the best podcasts around. Hear more at radiotopia.fm.
If you want to learn more about us, please go to our website, earhustlesq.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah, sign up for that newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I can't do this from prison because we're not allowed to have internet access, you can. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at earhustlesq. I'm Earlonne Woods.
And I'm Nigel Poor. Thanks for listening. Do you remember how she smelled?
I do. She smelled like lavender. She smelled like lavender.
Radiotopia. From PR.